And it is 26 minutes after the hour. It's a Transcendent Tuesday, and we welcome Dr. Don Clark. He lives in Garden Valley, Texas, and he joins us just about every Tuesday. Don, we've been working very hard on Daniel, and this is a whole lot to get your brain around. I've read Daniel several times in the past, and I always thought it was a good story. I even looked it up one time, and I know you differ in this opinion, but a lot of so-called biblical scholars say it was probably written around, you know, after the return to Jerusalem and the attempt to build the temple, so like the 500s, and it was recapping what had happened in Babylon earlier. You think it was more contemporary to the actual events, don't you?
Well, I can't, say for obviously 100% sure of that, but it's such detail that obviously one would think that, you know, an eyewitness had to be there, and the eyewitness being Daniel.
And you would say Daniel wrote it, except for this part. We're about to get into chapter 4, and this is a little different, isn't it?
Oh, it's quite different from the point of view that a Gentile actually wrote chapter 4 of Daniel. And this Gentile happened to be King Nebuchadnezzar. And it's interesting that it's even included in the Bible, but it's another, it's one of, obviously, another dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had, that God was working on him and working on his heart.
Well, if God inspires all Scripture, he had some purpose in this. And you've already mentioned that the book of Daniel is in essence the history of the Gentile people from that time forward to maybe even today.
Oh, not only today, till the end of the Gentile period.
Oh.
I mean, it's up until Jesus returns again. That's how far it goes. So it covers a lot of ground. And as you said, this was probably back in the 500 BC, 600 BC time frame.
I would think that people then were still pretty close to the events of the captivity, which was only 70 years. I mean, just a generation removed, maybe two generations. And they were sincere record keepers, the Jews. In fact, their culture thrived in Babylon. And even years after the Persians took over Babylon and there were more migrations back to Israel, there were a lot of Jews that stayed there, and it became a Jewish study center, didn't it?
Well, that's a strong possibility. Certainly Daniel stayed. You know, he didn't leave. There were others that obviously most of them left and went back.
Daniel was a boy, a teenager, when he went into captivity. So he was simply a mature adult by the time people started returning to Jerusalem. So he was in the midst of all that, I would think.
Oh yes, yeah, very much so. Now he, you know, probably 70s. Well, he had to be older than 70. He had to be in his 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But there, we just got finished with the Christmas season, and you know, you often wonder, well, where did the wise men come from? It says that they came from the east, but how far east did they come?
Mm-hmm.
And it is possible that the wise men were actually disciples of Daniel. And so Daniel stayed in Babylon, if you will, even when King Cyrus came along, and he died in Babylon, and you know, he probably had disciples and probably, you know, taught them in the ways of basically dream interpretation and other things. And Babylon was certainly a center for astrology and all kinds of stuff. You know, it was in Egypt, and then now.
Well, I know it was
Babylon.
A center for Zoroastrians, and many would say, and I believe that the wise men, however many there were Zoroastrians. They studied the skies, and they noted celestial phenomena and kind of read the stars for guidance. That's a pretty close.
But how would they have known that this particular sign that was in the heavens was actually pointing to the Messiah?
That may be the strongest evidence that they came from Babylon.
Yes. Yeah, and probably, like I said, were descendants of Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
But, interesting. Anyway, be that as it may, I mean, that's a lot of supposition on many people's parts. But it makes for not only a nice story, but it helps to explain possibly who the wise men were.
Well, it's logical.
Why they happen to know.
It's logical. It rings true. So.
And, you know, they obviously had a connection with God because God told them not to go back to Jerusalem and tell the king mm-hmm. where the Messiah was at that time, because Herod could not have two kings in the kingdom, mm-hmm. if you will. And so
we ended with the fiery furnace, and the three were there plus Jesus, you would say. And it looks like Nebuchadnezzar took note of all that in a serious way, because he promoted Daniel and his three friends to positions of authority in the kingdom. And now we go into chapter 4. We mentioned at the close of the last session that in Nebuchadnezzar's statement, he did not make a personal commitment to God or a confession of belief himself. But he lavished praise on God, kind of in the third person, but there's a change in chapter 4.
In chapter 4, there's very much a change because God changed his heart. I mean, he got his attention. It took a while, but he got his attention. So we left, and we don't know, you know, how long after the fiery furnace chapter 4 jumps in, but it probably was a significant time because King Nebuchadnezzar, after chapter 4, doesn't live all that long. You know, matter of fact, he only lives about a year after this particular episode. And then, you know, we get into the capture of Babylon.
His son takes the throne after his passing.
His son, one of his sons takes the throne, yes. And his son is certainly does not believe in God whatsoever. And so things aren't in good shape in Babylon at that time. But let's jump into chapter 4. So at the end of chapter 3, King Nebuchadnezzar sends out a proclamation basically saying that the God of Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, you know, anyone who says anything against that particular God, they're going to be in big trouble, because obviously that God is stronger than these other gods that my magicians are telling me, and the Chaldeans and everything are telling me are gods. So I think at that end of chapter 3, he doesn't really know. He just knows that, wow, this is a powerful God to save these three young boys from the fiery furnace. And as he said, it looked like the fourth was like a son of God. And indeed, he was the son of God. So he was right there. But the fourth doesn't come out of the fiery furnace, as you recall. So now we jump into chapter 4. And the tone changes for chapter 4 because King Nebuchadnezzar is writing it. And he sends out this letter. So chapter 4, I believe, is a letter to his kingdom, and it outlines the mysteries and the wonders that God is doing for King Nebuchadnezzar. And so why don't we just jump in and just, you know, take a look at what's going on. And King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all of the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I mean, it almost sounds like the Apostle Paul could have been writing this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So something has changed King Nebuchadnezzar's heart. Now, the dream and all of the interpretation and everything that's involved in the dream that we're getting ready to read, this has already taken place when he's writing this. So he's got a different perspective than he did, when he had the dream. So he says, It has seemed good to me. To whom? King Nebuchadnezzar. So that's how we know that King Nebuchadnezzar wrote this, to show the signs and the wonders that the Most High God has done for me. The Most High God. You know, he's a believer, or very close to it, because he's referring to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as the Most High God, because, Daniel is going to play a big role here, and Daniel, again, kind of saves the day.
There are four lines that almost sound like they came from the Psalms. In this, greeting.
This is somebody whose heart has been turned towards God and is praising God, right? Verse 3, it says, how great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures for generations to generations. Yes, David could have written this. You could put it to music. It
wouldn't surprise me if Nebuchadnezzar, having a revelation, an epiphany, that he would have, he's associated with Jews all around him. He must have seen some of the literature, perhaps including the Psalms, and adopted some of the language.
At this point in time, the Psalms haven't been written.
Well, if David wrote them, though, that's 900.
Were they? Yeah. Well, I guess that's right, because I'm back in Deuteronomy in my Bible study, so we haven't gotten to the Psalms. We haven't gotten to David yet. But yes, I think you're right. That was back in 900. So, yes, the Psalms would have been available, and whether King Nebuchadnezzar read them or not, he certainly at this point has a heart for God. There is no doubt about it. And maybe he is a believer at this point. It's that language is very strong and certainly reminds us of someone who is praising God and almost has a heart like David has, that he's softened to the one true God for sure. So let's jump in to his vision and his dreams. And he says, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace, and I saw a dream that made me afraid. Now, this is king of the world, right? Babylon is the world government.
The known world at the time, yeah.
Yeah, the known world. He is king over the whole known world, and he is afraid. So something must have really disturbed him. He got disturbed with the first dream, with the statue. Not so much the statue itself of him, but the rock that came from the heaven and crushed the statue and completely obliterated it, I think was the thing that really frightened him. But he's afraid again. So let's see what he's afraid of. And as I lay in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. So I made a decree that all the wise men of Babylon should be brought before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dreams. Then the magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, the astrologers came in, and I told them the dream. But they could not make known to me the interpretation. What does this sound like? This sounds like chapter 2.
It certainly does.
Well, except that King Nebuchadnezzar this time is telling them what the dream is. Mm-hmm. If you remember the first one, he didn't tell them. He said, you have to tell me what the dream is, and you have to tell me the interpretation. And they said, you know, no human can possibly.
Furthermore, this must be a new crew of magicians, because he did away with the first ones.
Well, he didn't, though, because of Daniel.
Oh, that's right. Daniel stood up for them.
Because he wanted to save his three friends as well. Mm-hmm. So they were saved because of Daniel. And so we continue in verse 8. At last, Daniel came in before me, and he who was named Belteshazzar, after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And I told him the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the God of the holy gods is in you, and that no mystery is too difficult for you, tell me the vision of my dreams that I saw and their interpretation. The vision of my head as I lay in bed were these. And so he begins his vision. But before we get off of that, there's a couple of points we need to make. One, he refers to Daniel by his real name. And, you know, two, he at this point, of course, the prelude to this is that King Nebuchadnezzar has already experienced what this dream is and its interpretation is going to, how it affects him. So he's got a different tone in the first several verses there. But here he's relaying it as if, okay, Daniel has a different spirit about him. And he's got this, you know, the spirit of the holy gods.
Yes, there's God's little g with an s on the end. Yeah, it's the gods, little gods.
Right, so he hasn't recognized yet who this God of Daniel really is. The other thing, he refers him to as the chief of the magicians. So Daniel then, and maybe that's a specific title that he has given to Daniel, he's in charge of the magicians, of the Chaldeans, and all of those folks that we read about before. He's top of the pecking order there. And so when Daniel comes in, he says, you know, surely Daniel can interpret this dream. So he then begins to tell him his dream. And the visions of my head as I lay in bed, and were these, I saw, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and it was, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. The leaves were beautiful, and its fruit abundant, and it was food for all. The beast of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the heavens lived in its branches, and all the flesh was fed from it. Now, we should be getting a clue now what this tree represents, right? But if you haven't as yet, these next several verses will help clue you in. I saw in the vision of my head as I lay in bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one. So he recognizes that this image that he saw, or the person that is about ready to do something to the tree, is special and is a watcher. I mean, could be an angel, could be, you know, he doesn't know. He just refers to it as an angel, but he knows it's a holy one, a watcher. He proclaimed aloud and thus said, chop down the tree from and lop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. The beast flee from under it and the birds from its branches. So this great tree that reaches up to heaven is going to be chopped down by the watcher, and all the birds and the animals and everything is going to be scattered from its midst, and the leaves and leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze.
There's iron and bronze again.
Yes. Isn't that interesting? Amid the tender grass of the field, let him be wet with the dew of heaven. Now, wait a minute. We're talking about a tree. How did the tree become personal? Let him be wet with the dew of the heaven. Let his portion be with the beast in the field, in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man's, now we know we're talking about a man, and let a beast's mind be given to him, and let 7 periods of time pass over him. So with this information, who is the man?
Well, it's got to be Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar, exactly.
See, I read the end of this, so I know that.
Yeah, okay. You read the interpretation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's King Nebuchadnezzar. Obviously, the language changes here. And the sentences by decree of the watcher and the decisions of the word of the Holy Ones, to the end that living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of man and gives it to him to whom he wills and sets over it the lowliest of man.
Ooh, that's a shot.
Yes. So this is a reminder to us too that God is the one who sets the men up over the kingdoms. I mean, the folks that are in charge tend to be extremely wicked. And you kind of scratch your head, well, you know, why is God allowing such wicked men to be in charge of the kingdom? And obviously God's interested in our hearts, not in the heart necessarily. Yes, he's interested in the hearts of the kings, but he's more interested in the hearts of the people. And God will do what he needs to do to get our attention, just like he's doing what he's doing now to King Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, this dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw, and you, O Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation. But you are able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you. So Nebuchadnezzar recognizes that if his magicians and the Chaldeans and all those folks, if they couldn't tell him, then Daniel is going to save the day. And then Daniel says, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was dismayed for a while, and this thought alarmed him. The king answered, said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation alarm you. But, Daniel understood immediately.
Well, he knew there was risk in what he said to the king. If he ticked him off, it could be there could be a serious penalty. So he was kind of on the spot there.
He was on the spot. But the other thing that we kind of get out of this is that Daniel is concerned for the king. In fact, may love King Nebuchadnezzar and may have had such a strong relationship with him. Now, remember, he's in charge of a lot of things. Nebuchadnezzar put him in charge of a lot of things because Nebuchadnezzar trusted him. And obviously, he's trusting him with the interpretation of this dream here. So with that in mind, we'll unveil the rest of the story here. Belteshazzar answers and said, my Lord, may the dream be for those who hate you and its interpretation for your enemies. So Daniel one could say, well, he's trying to soften the blow to King Nebuchadnezzar, but I think his heart's desire is that, oh no, this can't be for King Nebuchadnezzar, you know, not for my king. And so he responds in this way. And then he interprets the dream. He said, the tree that you saw, which grew and became strong so that its tops reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole world, earth, whose leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in which was food for all, under which beasts of the fields found shade, and in those branches the birds of the heavens lived. It is you, O king, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. So it is clear to Daniel that this vision is talking about King Nebuchadnezzar, because he is the king of the kingdom, and he is the one who provides for all of the people in the kingdom through his, in quote, great, you know, leadership, if you will, and provision. And because the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump and its roots bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, and let him be wet with dew of the heaven, and let his portion be with the beast of the field till seven periods of time.
In other words, let him be exposed to the elements.
Yes, let him be exposed to the elements, but his mind is going to be like a beast. And he's going to be eating grass, as we'll see. This is the interpretation, O king, and its decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that you shall be driven from among men. Okay, so he's not going to be in his right mind, and he actually is going to think he's a beast. And your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven. In seven periods of time shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he wills. So what does this sound like? I mean, until you recognize that it's the Most High who puts you in charge and not you. So King Nebuchadnezzar, looking forward here, is going to have a problem with pride. And we'll see that coming up. But King Nebuchadnezzar is going to be, his mind is going to be changed so that he thinks he's a beast, and he's going to be eating grass, and he's going to be out there soon. So in wrapping all of this up, King Nebuchadnezzar, this is exactly what happens to him. A year later, after this vision, it seems like he forgets about the vision. And he goes on top of his palace, and he says, man, look at this place. Look what I have done. Look at this great place and this beautiful palace and kingdom that I've created. And as soon as he says that, his mind gets changed, and he winds up going down, basically, and eating grass for 7 years. And until, you know, his mind comes back to him.
And psychiatrists even have a name for the condition, I have read. I don't remember what it is. Yeah.
They have a name for this. And
that happened to other people.
Yes. It is called, I've got it in my notes here somewhere. Oh, lycanthropy.
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 Lycanthropy. That is lycanthropy.
Lycos perhaps. Means wolf, mm-hmm. and Anthropos means man. So man thinks he's a wolf. Basically, it's a mental disorder. But this one obviously is caused by God. Mm-hmm. And so, anyway, King Nebuchadnezzar goes through this for seven years, and then he realizes, oh my goodness, there, you know, God is God. He's the Most High, the one who's done this to me, and he's the one who set me up. And he humbles himself and admits it. And when he does, his mind comes back to him. His kingdom is restored. And then he writes this letter that we pretty much mostly read, and comes to his senses again. All of this time, though, it's Daniel who is taking care of him in the field. It's Daniel who goes and checks on him, making sure he's okay, that nothing happens.
So many parallels again with Joseph in Egypt. I mean, there are all kinds of similarities between the situations of the two. Not that I believe in reincarnation, but Daniel had a Joseph-like spirit somehow. He was a caretaker kind of person.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. And he loved his king. And he took care of him.
Well, part five next week, you think?
Part five,
we got more to go.
I mean, we've got to get to the juicy parts, and maybe we'll try something else.
We'll look forward to the juicy parts.
We haven't gotten to the ultimate part yet. But the other thing about this particular passage is it's prophetic, and we can maybe start off with the prophetic aspects of what's being talked about here.
We'll look forward to that. Dr. Don, again, a board member at Creation Moments. CreationMoments.com is their website. If you go there, you'll discover all kinds of scientific information that supports and explains and enables you to teach the biblical story of creation. It's a great place to visit. New website is being prepared, but the old one is nothing to be embarrassed about. Head over to creationmoments.com, take a look, and let us know what you see. I think it'd be worth a trip. Don, thanks very much. We'll look forward to next Tuesday, okay?
Yes, indeed. You folks have a great week.
Bye-bye.